Nemoto presents scientific giants. Galileo Galilei, astronomer. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 26 minutes. You're listening to Scientific Giants Who Changed Our Understanding of the World We Live In. Each episode stands beside one mind and follows a thread of curiosity until it ties to the world we inhabit. Today we step into a workshop where glass dust floats in the sunlight like a slow snow and a man with quick hands is trying to teach two imperfect lenses to behave as one. Outside, Venice is a quarrel of water and stone, merchants arguing prices while gulls applaud. Inside, an instrument is being persuaded into clarity, and with it the sky is preparing to surrender its privacy. The man is Galileo Galilei, Tuscan by birth, mathematician by trade, artisan by temperament, polemicist by necessity. In his lifetime he will put a spyglass to his eye and see moons circling a planet that is not the Earth. He will watch shadows crawl along crater rims on the moon and deduce mountains. He will count stars where the naked eye swore there were only a few and turn mist into multitudes. He will trace the curve of a falling body and make it speak in squares of time. He will insist that when authority disagrees with measurement, the only honorable option is to build a better measurement. He will also misjudge, sometimes spectacularly, about tides, about how to keep friends when telling truths, and those errors will be as instructive as his triumphs. He did not invent doubt. He gave doubt a vernacular, instruments, a stage voice, and an impatient grin. Begin with a young man in Pisa who disliked being told that a heavy body falls faster than a lighter one because someone in a robe once said so. The story of him timing pendulums by watching a cathedral lamp sway is probably embroidered, but it has the right flavor. A student noticing that the world repeats when you give it the same arrangements. His father, Vincenzo, was a musician and a skeptical mind, the sort who quarreled with accepted tuning and insisted instruments should be tuned to the ear's truth rather than to inherited ratios. That domestic curriculum, teach your hands, distrust authority that cannot answer in sound or number, became a family trade. Galileo did not finish a medical degree. Mathematics stole him, and with mathematics the company of engineers and instrument makers, the people who turn description into steel or wood and then learn whether the description was honest. He taught first in Pisa, then Padua, and in Padua he became what his age needed and sometimes resisted, a public explainer whose blackboard could move a room. In an era before laboratories had their own architecture, he made a laboratory wherever he could hammer and sight and count. A plank plane smooth becomes an inclined plane. A water clock becomes a chronometer if you teach it to dribble steadily into a dish. A rough sighting tube becomes a ruler when you file a slit and line it with care. He made a geometric and military compass, a sector, so that gunners could compute the elevation of a cannon and merchants could divide a partnership without tears. He wrote manuals for its use in lucid prose, not for love of manuals but because he understood that a method that can be taught to the next hand is a public good. And then, in the summer of 1609, news reached him that in the Low Countries someone had made a tube that made distant things look close. No one sent him a blueprint. He set about making one himself because that is what he knew how to do. Reverse engineer a rumor into a tool. What he built at first was a toy with ambitions. Two lenses, simple convex objectives and concave eyepieces, ground on tin plates with abrasive impatience, mounted in a tube that liked to misbehave. 8 power. Then 20. He learned, with a craftsman's humility, how much the sky punishes sloppy glass. Getting the lenses right is only half the job. The other half is alignment, the snugness of the tube, the steadiness of the mount, the discipline of the eye. Venice offered him roofs and bell towers for testing, ships in the lagoon to count rigging lines, inscriptions on distant facades to read. When the instrument worked on earthly targets, he pointed it at the moon. When the moon consented to show itself in raking light, he was ready. With that turn, the moon ceased to be a platonic ornament and became, once again, a place. He saw shadows ragged and alive. He saw bright peaks catching dawn before neighboring plains had shrugged off night. He saw lacy borders where light fell across rough ground. In the old cosmology, the moon lived above the changeable air and therefore should be perfect. No rust, no rot, no scab or wrinkle. Galileo used the play of light to estimate heights. Shadow lengths become a ruler when you know the sun's angle. The geometry is as old as the Egyptians, but this time it was applied to a world that convention said had no texture. His little book, Sidereus Nuncius, The Starry Messenger, was a trumpet blast played on a flute, thin, quick, cheerful, devastating. He drew what he saw. He dedicated the book to Cosimo de' Medici of Florence and named the four small bodies he found near Jupiter the Medicean stars, so that astronomy and patronage could be married without scandal. Patronage was not only vanity, it was oxygen. Instruments cost money. Enemies gather where resources are thin. A prince's name on a title page is an insurance policy against sudden hunger. Jupiter's moons were not an ornament. They were a proof of concept. Here, before anyone's comfort could intervene, was a miniature system with a center that was not the Earth. The nightly dance of those tiny lights, two to the east, one to the west, then all four in a line, then one hidden, was a recurring argument against the notion that everything must circle us. If they could circle Jupiter while Jupiter and Earth circled the Sun, the cosmos was not a set of crystal spheres carrying lanterns like an elaborate chandelier. It was a layer cake of motion superposed. One could imagine worlds galore, each keeping its own small parliament of companions. Even if you preferred Tycho's compromise, planets around the Sun, Sun around a parked Earth, the Medicean stars made it impossible to hold that the very idea of circling something other than Earth was absurd. He turned the tube to the Milky Way, that river of chalk the naked eye could not resolve, and found not mist but crowds. He wrote with the delight of an accountant who discovers the treasury is not empty after all. The Milky Way is a congeries of innumerable stars. That sentence is an early schooling in humility. The naked eye had made a texture where there were individual things. The spyglass revealed a census so large it made the old maps of the sky feel like children's drawings. He looked at nebulous patches and found that some were indeed smokes of stars, while others remained soft, mysteries left for instruments that did not yet exist. He looked at Saturn and thought it was three bodies, one large, two small attendants fused to its sides, only to watch the ears vanish when the ring turned. He looked at Venus and saw phases like the moon's, fattening to gibbous and thinning to a fingernail. Those phases are incompatible with a Venus that rides between Earth and Sun on a small epicycle, but natural if Venus circles the Sun inside our orbit. He looked at the Sun and saw dark wandering stains, sunspots, alive and mutable. He risked his eyes to do it. Later he would invent safer methods, projecting the solar image onto a card so the spots could be traced daily. With that tracing he could watch the Sun spin, not by assuming nobility but by counting specks as they made their way across the disk. Each observation was a stone thrown at a stained glass window that had long pleased philosophers. He knew what he was breaking and he did not break things for sport. He wrote with breezy certainty when he had repeated a sighting enough times to trust it. He sharpened his language like a chisel when he knew an opponent would try to wiggle out by calling an artifact an optical illusion. He loved the craft that refused to lie. The complaints came quickly. Some said the spyglass could not be trusted. It created phantoms. He replied, in essence, it reads the distant as if it were near. If you trust a straight edge and a plumb line, trust this tube, which only changes scale. He invited doubters to look. Some refused. He laughed and then grew dangerous. He did not merely offer numbers. He offered conversion experiences at the eyepiece and then judged those who would not look as people protecting their pride rather than their communities. There is a way, he argued, that you can still hear in labs and workshops. Instruments make arguments more honestly than mouths do. He understood that rhetoric matters, he was a master of it, but he believed that a device that lets nature draw its own picture is an ethical act. He wrote letters as public pamphlets, addressing princes and grand duchesses not because he liked finery but because he wanted the highest offices to see that the world, when arranged properly, will ignore rank and salute method. His letter to the Grand Duchess Christina tried to teach an awkward lesson to people who liked their scriptures flat. That sacred texts teach salvation, not ephemerides, and that the God who made the heavens also made instruments and minds capable of reading them. It was a plea for non-overlapping duties, made eloquently, and it failed to protect him when the politics of Rome took new turns. But before the trial, before the house in Arce try, there was the joyful labor of a man discovering how to talk about motion without blushing. Aristotelian physics had organized change into categories that smelled like philosophy. Heavy bodies sought their natural place, fire its own. Toss a stone and the air closes behind it like a polite crowd and lends violent motion until the stone's nature reasserts itself. This grammar kept company with common sense as long as no one insisted that motion be measured, not narrated. Galileo built measuring into boards and brass. The incline became a time dilator. By letting gravity work on a slope rather than in a plunge, he slowed the fall enough that water clocks and songs could keep time. He rolled balls and marked distances. After a dozen trials, then 100, the distances grew as the squares of the times. He did not have calculus. He had ratios that anyone could follow with chalk and patience. He found that equal increments of time add equal increments of speed when a body is uniformly accelerated. He turned that into a law of falling bodies. He also learned to trace the path of a projectile as a blend, a horizontal inertial persistence and a vertical gravitational pull. The result, in a vacuum that no one yet knew how to make, would be a perfect parabola. Air made the curve messy. He knew that but did not let mess drown the idea. In the dialogues later, he would put the argument into the mouths of three friends, one of them a hothead, one a gentleman, one a mouthpiece for the old school, and he would let their conversation show that a gun's shot curves for reasons stricter than the air's caprice. He taught Europe to think with components, to analyze a motion into parts that add vectorially even if the word vector is a long way off. He refuted the old claim that motion requires a mover co-present. He edged toward inertia, that tendency of a body to keep doing what it is doing unless acted upon. He did not nail the law in Newton's later form. He suggested it with a shipboard parable that still lives as a test for whether a student has learned to distrust absolute claims about motion. He asked us to go below deck on a smoothly moving vessel and watch flies buzzing, drops fall, fish swim, dice tumble, and notice that nothing in their dances betrays the ship's steady motion. If you cannot detect the ship's motion without looking outside, then motion is relative and frames matter. That single image, so domestic, so free of equations, did more to re-educate intuition than a shelf of syllogisms. His appetite for experiment did not make him disdain theory, it made him disdain bad metaphors. In the Assayer, he wrote a sentence that students still quote as if it were carved into physics laboratory doors. That philosophy is written in the grand book of the universe, which is continually open to our gaze, but it cannot be understood unless one first learns to comprehend the language and recognize the characters in which it is written. It is written in mathematical language, and its characters are triangles, circles, and other geometric figures. One can argue with the absolutism of the claim. One cannot deny that it gave generations permission to trade metaphysical comfort for calculable rhythm. The Assayer also made enemies because it was not only a treatise on comets and atomism, it was a virtuoso performance of invective. Galileo could write like a fencer, feint, thrust, riposte. He could also write like a man who enjoys beating opponents at more games than they knew they were playing. His sunspot letters sharpened the tone. Christoph Scheiner, a Jesuit, also observed the spots and preferred to keep the sun's purity intact by suggesting that the spots were small planets, starlets, hovering near the sun. Galileo argued for stains on the sun's surface, not to insult the sun but because the spots' shapes changed as they slid and the foreshortening near the limb argued they lay on the sun, not beyond it. Beneath the astronomy was a dispute about what kinds of perfection the heavens could be expected to honor. Galileo mocked in a key that made later reconciliation with powerful orders harder. He picked fights not only when he had to, he picked them when the polemical heat was fun. If this were only a story of eye, hand, and mouth making the world less mysterious, it would be a happy one. It turns, as many such stories do, on the hinge of power. In 1616, Copernicus' heliocentrism was filed under unsafe to teach as truth. A Roman decree did not annihilate ideas. It put them behind a screen. Galileo received a private warning. Do not hold or defend the motion of the earth as a physical truth. Discuss it, if you must, as a mathematical convenience. He remained a courtier of knowledge. He visited Rome, charmed officials, argued that he was not a rebel but a servant of clearer calendars and a friend to theology that refused to compete where it need not. For a time he succeeded. A new pope, Urban VIII, admired his wit and learning. Galileo returned to Florence with a sense that the door had opened a handspan. He wrote the dialogue concerning the two chief world systems as if to honor the letter of the restrictions and defeat their spirit. It is a four-day conversation among three men, nominally about astronomy but in practice about method, habit, and courage. Salviati is Galileo with the gloves off. Segreto is the generous gentleman who enjoys good sense, Simplicio is the honest but befuddled Aristotelian who repeats slogans as if they were arguments. The book is fun to read, a rare feat for a physics text. It does not so much argue as invite listeners to watch their own intuitions betray them and then laugh with relief when a better picture presents itself. It also contains a flawed tide theory. Galileo tried to prove the Earth's motion by claiming that sloshing in the seas was a consequence of the Earth's accelerations as it rotates and revolves. He was wrong. The moon is the main engine of tides. He could not forgive himself for not having a decisive proof, and he pressed the wrong one too hard. His enemies would use the error as proof of hubris. His friends winced. Urban VIII recognized himself in a passage where Simplicio utters a papal argument that God's omnipotence could make the world appear in such a way that any system that predicts well enough could be acceptable. Therefore, do not presume to say it must be so and not otherwise. Galileo had placed the Pope's favorite line in the mouth of the least impressive character. Whether that was a miscalculation or a dare depends on your taste. In any case, it made the next chapter of his life inevitable. He was summoned to Rome, tried before the Inquisition, and in 1633 coerced into abjuring that the earth moves. The sentence consigned him to house arrest. He spent the rest of his life in a villa at Arcetri, supervised by men who could not stop him from thinking but could control whom he saw and what he published. The famous whisper, "And yet it moves," is a souvenir invented later. The truth needs no embroidery. He signed what he had to sign and then, grieved and tired, went home and kept working. The work was not small. If the dialogue had been a stage play for astronomy, the book he now wrote was a workshop manual for mechanics. The discourses and mathematical demonstrations relating to two new sciences announced, without modesty and without pomposity, that there were two subjects on which he wanted to report after 40 years of thinking: the strength of materials and the laws of motion. He could not print it in Italy. He quietly sent the manuscript north to Leiden, where Elsevier published it in 1638. In its pages, massed again as dialogue, Galileo taught Europe how to compare beams by scale, how the square cube law means that as you scale an object up, its volume and weight grow faster than its cross-sectional strength, and therefore giants require different architecture than mice. He explained why large ships must be proportioned differently than small ones, why a muscle cannot simply be made longer without becoming weaker, why bone shapes are a negotiation with stress. He treated fracture not as a moral failure but as a mathematical event. Then he returned to motion with the patience of an old man who no longer wants to win a debate but to teach a craft. He derived the odd number rule for distances traversed in equal times under uniform acceleration. He proved that the path of a projectile is a parabola in a vacuum. He formalized the pendulum's approximate isochronism for small swings, the very property that would later be used by Huygens to regulate clocks. He described a clinching experiment about inertia that anyone can still do. Place a ball in a circular bowl, start it rolling, it will climb the opposite side to nearly the same height if friction is small. Flatten one side gradually, the ball will travel farther along the flat and then up the curve to the same height. Flatten both sides and you get a ball that travels indefinitely if nothing resists it. Motion persists. Rest is not more natural than motion. He did not brandish this as a metaphysical creed. He showed it with wood and patience. He mocked words that tired him. Impetus, nature, levity, he wanted fewer words and better numbers. He also wrote with genuine curiosity about what the world could be made to reveal with instruments. The thermoscope, an ancestor of the thermometer, is the sort of contrivance that falls between domains. A ball of air connected to a tube and bulb, air expanding with heat, pushing water up and down, making temperature visible as height. He played with it without pretending it was exact. He handed it to others with the gentle suggestion that if they could build a scale into it and isolate pressure's mischief, it might become a public measure. He also loved spectacle when it could be disciplined. A magnet is a show-off. He made it a citizen by showing what it would do under repeatable conditions. He did not so much demystify as redirect wonder toward things that would yield to method. If you are making a portrait for the ear, you must include the texture of him. Funny, impatient, proud, sometimes reckless with friends, consistently tender toward instruments and toward the few who cared for him when money and protection failed. He could be a bully when he thought an argument lazy, and a charmer when he needed a scholar's exception or a cardinal's acquiescence. He loved to win and did not always choose the battle wisely. He was a better scientist than politician, which is one reason his life ended under supervision. But consider the record of his supervision. He was not silenced, in fact. He moved his work to topics his judges did not understand or care to control. He kept corresponding. He trained assistants. He arranged for publication in friendlier jurisdictions. That was not cowardice. It was a craftsman's stubbornness. If the door is locked, find a window. If the window is barred, send the pages out under a coat. He made enemies among people who did not deserve to be his enemies. Sometimes the Jesuits are painted as monolithic opponents. Their scholars were among the most skilled mathematicians and observers of the day. He had friends among them and squandered some of those friendships. He had friends in Rome and lost them because he allowed his gift for ridicule to do the work of argument. These were tactical errors. They make a moral for our time. If you are right on the facts, you are still obliged to be patient with institutions made of people. If you want a method to survive you, it helps to send it abroad in tones that your enemies can live with. His method survived anyway because it worked on wood and glass and stone, but the centuries he might have saved by being gentler are not imaginary. There are other rooms we should not leave without entering. In 1604 a new star appeared, Kepler's supernova, though Kepler saw it from Prague and Galileo lectured on it in Padua. New stars are not allowed in a heaven of unchanging spheres. He turned the event into a chalkboard demonstration that the sky was not a fixed furniture. He taught crowded lecture halls until they were too full for breath. Not because the young men loved astronomy as such, but because they loved the permission to watch doctrines loosen their grip under the pressure of a blackboard and a telescope. He was already, in those years, the thing our culture barely knows how to value. A teacher whose demonstrations change how future artisans, physicians, jurists, and clerks imagine what counts as truth. Even his mistakes are pedagogically rich. The tide theory failed because it was motivated by a desire for a mechanical proof of the Earth's motion and by disdain for using the moon as a cause. He wanted the Earth's double motion, daily and yearly, to slosh the seas as a bucket sloshes when carried in a circle. He underestimated the mutual gravitation that would later explain tides. He underestimated the Earth-Moon system's dance. He overestimated the explanatory rule that explanations should be terrestrial. In making that error public, he taught a lesson that his admirers must keep learning. Your preferred style of explanation does not bind the world. The world takes the explanations that fit, not the ones you think are elegant. He taught the lesson by failing at it. It is a generous failure. What did he change that touches our day, aside from the content of physics texts and the ways telescopes are pointed? He changed how we expect public arguments to be won. Before him, a philosopher could claim victory by authority, analogy, and wit. After him, the person who can build the arrangement that forces a result becomes the arbiter. He changed the kind of prose that makes people trust a claim. Draw a figure, tell us what you did, show us the numbers, let a stranger see the same thing. He changed the practical life of artisans because he wrote mathematics in a tone that did not condescend to shops. He changed training by insisting that the novice has the right to see, not only to hear. He changed jurisprudence indirectly by making it respectable to demand procedures in any discipline claiming truth. Method sections are his grandchildren. We can argue, if we want to stock a quiet evening with ghosts, about who really started the scientific revolution. The argument is as useful as arguing whether the dawn started at the first gray or the first shadowless sun. Galileo is dawn, not noon. He did not have Newton's calculus or law of gravitation. He did not have Kepler's ellipses. He did not have Hooke's spring or Huygens' clock. He had a tube, boards, weights, water, and an angry joy in watching assertions fail. He lit enough of the eastern sky that the rest became inevitable for anyone willing to walk toward the light. Picture him in the last years, blind in one eye and failing in the other, in Arse Tri with a few students, one of whom will edit and publish his book abroad. He dictates, he cups a model of a bone and talks about how it breaks. He jests about how professors love to put words to things that do not need them. He drinks the wine a friend brought from town and sighs at the business of breathing. If you listen without reverence, you hear not a martyr but a stubborn artisan of truth, working to the end on the two crafts he loved, making instruments honest and language precise. If there is a prayer in his work, it is simple. Let what we say about the world be earned by what the world does when we arrange it carefully. We leave him with one more small scene. A boy in Padua, held up to look through a telescope, draws back with a sound that is not a word. He has seen the moon as a place instead of a disk, and something shifts behind his ribs that will not shift back. He will not become a philosopher. He will become a bridge builder, or a physician, or a map maker. And in each of those lives he will be a little less willing to accept a claim that presents itself without a method. That is Galileo's true revolution, a civic change in what counts as persuasion. You have been listening to Scientific Giants Who Changed Our Understanding of the World We Live In. Today we climbed workshop stairs and bell towers, and watched a Tuscan with a spyglass and a temper teach a civilization to trade authority for procedure, symmetry for measurement, story for experiment, and to smile when an instrument reveals that our intuitions are crude. In our next episode, we will walk into the study of Johannes Kepler, a melancholic mathematician who turned a set of numbers into ellipses and found in those curves a new kind of necessity, the laws that bind planets and, by echo, bind falling apples to the earth. Until then, thank you for your attention and your time. This episode was written as a continuous story for the ear. If it moved you, bring a friend along next time. Until our next hour together, keep an eye on the arrangements you lean on, they are closer than they look.